OU Israel presents
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for the upcoming Three Kugel Shabbat. That means that we have three Torahs. There's a custom in some communities to have one Kugel on Shabbat for each Torah that we take out and read from. This Shabbat is one of those rare Shabbatot that we read from three Torah scrolls. In the first one, we read the weekly portion, which is Pekudei. We'll talk some about that. In the second Torah, we read of the portion for Rosh Chodesh, which this Shabbat is, the first day of the second Adar. And this is the first of the four special Shabbatot called the Arba Parshiot, this one Parshat Shkalim. So, you ask, what is a Kugel? Answers.com to the rescue. Of course, I could tell it to you without that, but according to the dictionary definition, it is a baked pudding of noodles or potatoes, eggs, and seasonings traditionally eaten by Jews on the Sabbath. A little bit more of an explanation in Food Lover's Companion. Kugel is the traditionally served on the Jewish Shabbat. Kugel is a baked pudding usually made with potatoes or noodles, though meat, vegetables, and other ingredients are sometimes included. It's generally served as a side dish, though a sweet version with raisins and spices is equally delicious as dessert. Wikipedia dictionary says that kugel is from the Yiddish, which can be pronounced either kugel or kegel, depending on where you come from. It is one of a wide variety of traditional baked Jewish side dishes or desserts. It is sometimes translated as pudding or casserole. Let me add that in Israel, in Hebrew, it is often known as a pashtida, but nothing is like a kugel. Kugels may be sweet or savory. The most common types are made from egg noodles, called lokshen kugels, or potatoes, and often contain eggs, but there are recipes in everyday use in modern Jewish kitchens for a great diversity of kugels made with different vegetables, fruits, batters, cheese, and other flavorings and toppings. Had enough? That's the story of kugel. Oh, here's an entry called The History of Kugels. The first kugels were made from bread and flour and were savory rather than sweet. About 800 years ago, their flavor and popularity improved when cooks in Germany replaced bread mixtures with noodles or farfel. Eventually, eggs were incorporated. The addition of cottage cheese and milk created a custard-like consistency, which is common in today's dessert dishes. Then there are sweet kugels, savory kugels, kugels on Jewish festivals. Kugels are a mainstay of festive meals in Ashkenazi Jewish homes. Some Hasidic Jews believe that eating kugel on the Jewish Sabbath brings special spiritual blessings, particularly if that kugel was served on the table of a Hasidic Rebbe. Since this show originates in Jerusalem, we should mention the Yerushalmi kugel, a favorite here in Yerushalayim, as well as many, many other places in Israel and abroad, made of noodles with a very combination of sugar and black pepper to give it both tastes at the same time. Anyone who has had Yerushalmi kugel doesn't need me to explain it. Anyone who hasn't, my explanation probably wouldn't help. You'll just have to have it, and of course with its accompaniment required of sliced pickle. Be that as it may, somebody came up with the idea that there should be one kugel for each Torah that is read. So I affectionately refer to this Shabbat as a three Kugel Shabbat. What I mean is a three Torah Shabbat, as I already explained before. As a side point, on the humorous side is an ongoing debate as to whether two different types of noodle kugel can qualify as separate enough to get the number three kugels, or you really have to have three totally different main ingredients. I leave that to you to argue. A personal favorite of mine is quinoa or quinoa kugel. Because of the South Beach diet that I'm on, it precludes regular egg noodles or bread puddings or rice puddings or potato puddings and kugels. So I'm left with quinoa kugel, which I have yet to make, but one of these days I will, maybe even for this Shabbat. Recording and first broadcast of this week's Torah Tidbits audio is on Thursday, Yom Chamishi, the 29th of Adar Aleph, or Adar Rishon, the first Adar as it is called, in the year 5768. On the secular calendar, it is March 6th, which leads me to wish both my brother Nachum a happy birthday a number of days ago, and my cousin Michael a happy birthday either today or tomorrow. I never remember whether it's the 6th or the 7th of March, but may you both live in health and happiness with much nachas from your families and they from you. Ad mea ve'esrim shana. Brother Nachum, cousin Michael, and everyone else with a birthday at this time of the year. As is our custom of recent vintage, when we don't say Tachanun in the morning or afternoon davening, we switch from Psalm 130 to Psalm 121. This is not an existing custom. This is one that I sort of introduced at the Israel Center and on Torah Tidbits Audio. So we will say Psalm 121 as follows. Shir lama'alot esa einai el heharim me'ayin yavo ezri. Ezri me'im Adonai ose shamayim v'oretz. Al yitain lamot raglecha al yonum shomrecha. Hine lo yonum v'lo yishon shomer Yisrael. Adonai shomrecha, Adonai tzilecha al yad yiminecha. Yomam hashemesh lo yakeka v'yoreach baloyla. Adonai yishmorcha mikol ra yishmor et nafshecha. Adonai yishmor tseisecha uvoecha me'ata v'yad olam. Achinu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara uvashivya ha'omdim bein bayam uvein bayabasha. Hamakom yirachem aleihem v'yotziyem mitzara lirvacha umeafela laora umishibud l'geula. Hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. Before I get into the three Torah topic, I would like to bring up a topic which is not purely within the domain of this show, but it is. And if that sounds confusing, contradictory, or even wishy-washy, I hope to clarify it. I don't want to clarify it now. I'd rather talk about what I want to talk about, but then I do want to explain why I feel so strongly about taking time on Torah Tidbits Audio to present this. Last week, early in the week, I don't remember which day, there was a resolution passed by consensus of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs, which is an umbrella organization of 14 Jewish organizations in the United States, one of which is the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America, now known as the Orthodox Union, which is the parent organization of the Israel Center and OU Israel, which I have been affiliated and associated with these last 26 years, and OU and NCSY in the States for years before that. So I am part of the OU family, and I am not now going to editorialize any more than taking the time on Torah Tidbits Audio, which is broadcast on both Israel National Radio, which is Arut Sheva, as well as on OU Radio, which is the Orthodox Union, to report the following. And I probably won't be able to avoid a little bit of editorializing. The Jewish Council for Public Affairs passed a resolution last week I'm not going to go through the background of the resolution or all of its points, but one particular item caused a storm of emails and phone calls back and forth and protest letters and comments, etc., etc. The resolution called for the organized American Jewish community should affirm its support for two independent, democratic, and economically viable states, the Jewish state of Israel and a state of Palestine, living side by side in peace and security. We note with sorrow that Israel's repeated offers to establish two democratic states living side by side in peace and security have been met time after time by violence, incitement, and terror. Notwithstanding the second sentence of that paragraph, the first part calls upon the organized American Jewish community to affirm its support for two independent, democratic, and economically viable states in Eretz Yisrael, in the land of Israel, a Jewish state of Israel, and what they call a state of Palestine. There is another, again, I said it wouldn't editorialize, but I will, another highly offensive clause in this resolution. I don't know if I'll get into it now. The irksome thing from the perspective of someone in the Orthodox Jewish community and someone in the Orthodox Union family is the fact that we first heard of this resolution and that the OU abstained as the only member organization who did not vote yes in favor of this resolution. Immediately thereafter, on the OU's website was a clarification, OU position and role on the JCPA resolution. The Orthodox Union is a member agency of the JCPA, etc., etc. As reported in the media, the JCPA debated and adopted a resolution with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. The media report, however, did not fully and accurately present the Orthodox Union's position and activities with regard to the resolution, so we do so here. The OU delegation engaged in the debate over the resolution by proposing and or opposing provisions of or amendments to the resolution text. The following were the actions of the OU on this matter. The OU attempted to remove, try to catch this language, the OU attempted to remove the resolution's text, which would have, for the first time, put JCPA on record in support of the two-state solution, but we were defeated by a vote of the delegates to the JCPA. The OU succeeded in inserting a certain clause. The OU attempted to remove the text calling for American Jewish support for any negotiations by the Israeli government over the redivision of Jerusalem, but we were defeated by a vote of the delegates to the JCPA. The OU succeeded in inserting into the resolution text, which calls upon the American Jewish community to support Israel's insistence on being recognized by the Palestinian Authority as a Jewish state. The OU succeeded in defeating another proposal or an amendment. At the conclusion of the debate and amendment process, the OU delegation abstained from the vote on final passage of the resolution and informed, right up front, informed the JCPA of our intention to file a formal written dissent from the portions of the resolution with which the OU disagrees. Yesterday, March 5th, the OU published on their website an OU dissent from the JCPA resolution. With regard to the resolution on the Israeli-Palestinian peace process adopted at the 2008 plenum, the Orthodox Union does not agree with and dissents from the statement that, quote, the organized American Jewish community should affirm its support for two independent, democratic, and economically viable states, the Jewish state of Israel and a state of Palestine, living side by side in peace and security. As stated in our amendment to the resolution's text, we note with sorrow that Israel's repeated offers for establishing two democratic states living side by side, etc., have been met time and time after time by violence and incitement. Hamas controls the Gaza Strip, etc. The Orthodox Union further disagrees with and dissents from the resolution statement that the American Jewish community should support an Israeli government's negotiation efforts with regard to the status of Jerusalem. Should that include the government of Israel's possible assent to the redivision of the Holy City, which the global Jewish community continues to view as the eternal and indivisible capital of Israel and the Jewish people. So far, what do we have? We have a resolution of the Jewish Council for Public Affairs. We have a clarification of the OU's abstention from the voting on that resolution. And then we have the official dissent of the OU on the two most irksome clauses of that resolution. Now, before this came about, meaning that dissent was actually published yesterday, there were a lot of calls back and forth. We received calls at the Israel Center, being the OU in Israel presence here, and we were in close touch with New York office about this issue. I had questioned why we didn't vote no. Nobody seems to really understand why we didn't vote no right away, but apparently the dissent, which came a number of days later, is still part of the protocol and is duly noted. Furthermore, I asked why we didn't use a veto, which apparently each organization member has the opportunity to do because the JCPA works on consensus. And consensus means basically everybody agreeing. So I was told that the OU reserves its veto power for religious issues. And here comes my point in bringing up this whole topic in this context of Torah Tidbits Audio. Torah Tidbits Audio. And that is my reaction. You could agree or not agree that we're dealing here not with a political issue. We're dealing here with nothing less than pikuach nefesh, a life-threatening situation to the state of Israel and to all the Jews who live in Israel, as well as all Jews anywhere. Being pikuach nefesh, being a life-threatening situation, I feel, taking the lead from the well-known maxim, pikuach nefesh doche Shabbat, that pikuach nefesh trumps Shabbat, pushes aside the Shabbat, one may violate the Shabbat in order to save a life, that to me and my understanding, and I admit and I recognize that the people in the New York office, in the administration there, have many, many other factors that weigh into their decisions, which I don't know about and I don't relate to necessarily. I'm looking at it from my personal perspective only, that this is a pikuach nefesh situation, that a two-state solution, supposedly, that the existence of a recognized Palestinian or Arab state within the borders of the land of Israel is totally detrimental, harmful, and dangerous to the people of Israel and to the state of Israel, that it is more important than a religious issue, and in my personal opinion, warranted a veto. Be that as it may, the dissent is very, very clear, and I think that Arut Sheva was premature in its negative reporting of this whole process in yesterday's release on the internet. And I plan on talking to the author of the article and the people that be there that I felt that they took an unnecessarily negative slant towards the OU. And I feel in a unique situation being a show host for both the OU as well as Arut Sheva that I could say these things on Torah Tidbits Audio. It could also turn out that I'll get both Arut Sheva and OU upset at different things that I say. And it's not, I'm ready for it. So that's what I wanted to say. Without further ado, there's a long piece that I shared very recently, meaning an hour ago, with the folders on the upcoming Parshat Shkalim, as well as the four special parshiot that it inaugurates, and I would like to share that with you now. As you know, we start the series of the four parshiot this Shabbat with Parshat Shkalim. Interestingly, for this year, the rest of the world has Shkalim, followed by Parshat Zohar, then a Hafsaka, a break, followed by Purah and HaChodesh. The span of the four parshiot always is 5 weeks or 6 weeks. Never could be done 4 weeks in a row based on the dating of each one. Specifically, Parshat Shkalim is the Shabbos of or before Rosh Chodesh Adar. When there are two Adars, it's always the Adar that's closest to Nisan, which is what's coming up. So this Shabbat is the first day of Adar Sheni, and that's when we read Shkalim. Zohar does not depend on a calendar date, it depends on the Shabbat before Purim. So, occasionally, there is a break in between Shkalim and Zohar. Most often there is not, and this year there is not. This week is Shkalim. Next week would be the 8th of Adar. That's Zohar, because the following Friday / Shabbat is Purim. Then you have to go to the end. Parshat HaChodesh is the Shabbat of or right before Rosh Chodesh Nisan. The Shabbat before it is always Parshat Parah. Parshat Parah is the only one of the Arba Parshiot that doesn't depend on something on the calendar, but it depends on HaChodesh. In other words, there's never a break between Parah and HaChodesh. The other possible break, besides between Shkalim and Zohar, is between Zohar and Parah, which there is this year, which in Yerushalayim, we fill in that break with Purim. So we've got a trivia question, which I'm going to tell you the answer to, and that is five Shabbatot in a row, where we take out at least two Sifrei Torah. The only place it happens is Yerushalayim. And the only year that it happens is an 11.5% frequency of a year like this one that has Purim on Shabbat in Yerushalayim, that has Pesach on Motzoi Shabbat, and what goes along with that is a three Torah Shabbat for Shkalim, which is Rosh Chodesh. So this now will read three Torahs this Shabbos, two the following, two the one after that, two the one after that, and two the one after that. This is five in a row. Very noteworthy, we'll say.
I'm Rod Sterling. You're listening to
Torah Tidbits Audio.
Rest your eyes.
Let's continue now on that mini-shear to the Torah Tidbits folders, bringing in the listenership of Torah Tidbits Audio to that very special operation. The other thing about Shkalim, about all of the Arba Parshiot, is they're not equal in their, in their requirement and what is being fulfilled when we do them. In other words, what I'm trying to say is, Parshat Zohar, which is not this Shabbat but next Shabbat, is the fulfillment of a mitzvah in the Torah. The Torah says to remember what Amalek did. Chazal said, do it the week before Purim to make the Amalek-Haman connection. But the reading of the Maftir of Parshat Zohar is the fulfillment of a Torah mitzvah. The reading, on the other hand, of Parshat Shkalim this Shabbat is not the fulfillment of a Torah mitzvah. It is, good question, one of two things. And I say it like that because different sources explain it differently. There's almost no practical difference between the two things that people argue what it is, but at least it's of academic interest. One opinion says that Parshat Zohar is a commemoration. In the time of the Beit HaMikdash, past and future, we are required to bring, to give a half silver shekel, a silver half shekel, I should say, to the collection fund of the Beit HaMikdash for that purpose. Men are obligated, women are optional givers. What I always like to mention is that in this particular gift to the Beit HaMikdash, non-Jews are not eligible to give. A non-Jew who lives in Eretz Yisrael, even one who fulfills the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, even one who fulfills the seven Noahide laws for the sake of the God of Israel, we say to him, sorry, you cannot give Machatzit HaShekel. That is a membership fee, an annual membership fee of the Jewish nation.
What about a gear
and a gear and a gioret are full Jews, and they give Machatzit HaShekel. But it's a membership. If they're in training, then they don't.
Oh, okay.
It's obligatory for men, optional for women, and not accepted from a non-Jew. A non-Jew who does offer it will say, well, here's another fund, which is called Bedek HaBayit, which are the repairs of the Beit HaMikdash, and when they need new vessels and stuff, and that's what that fund is used for, you want to give to that, we'll be glad to accept it. No, I want to give Machatzit HaShekel. This is membership in Klal Yisrael only. So one opinion is that the reading of Parshat Shkalim is a commemoration of a mitzvah which does not apply in our time, only applies in the time of the Beit HaMikdash. And Chazal said we want to commemorate that mitzvah to keep its memory alive for the future when we will do it again. And therefore we will read the portion, it's a 6-verse portion from the beginning of Parshat Ki Tisa on the mitzvah of Machatzit HaShekel. Why did they choose Rosh Chodesh Adar, or the Shabbat before Rosh Chodesh Adar? Kind of obvious. And then there's an extra point which makes it even more than obvious. The obvious answer is the very first Mishnah in Masechet Shkalim. The Mishnah says, Be'echad ba'adar, on the first day of Adar, Mashmi'in al Hashkalim va'al Hakalayim. The Sanhedrin would send out messengers. Today that would be emails and SMSs and public service address messages on television and radio. But in the olden times, it was a messenger who in Rosh Chodesh Adar all over the country would say, hear ye, the Sanhedrin is reminding you of two important mitzvot that have to be taken care of at this time of the year. One is the annual collection of the Machatzit HaShekel, and that will begin on the middle of the month, the 15th of the month, where we will have collectors who will be available to register your donation. And the other is not a mitzvat aseh like Machatzit HaShekel, not a positive command, but a prohibition to be avoided, and that is called Kalayim. Kalayim in this case refers to Kalai Kerem, which are the mixed plantings in a vineyard. The Torah forbids wheat and barley from being planted and growing together with grapes. If you have a field, whatever you want to call it, a vineyard, with grapes growing, and barley or wheat grow in it also, the grapes become forbidden to eat. And you will lose, not allowed to eat it. Even though there's nothing different in the grape, if you were to analyze it chemically and whatever, you would not see any difference. Kalai Kerem requires the separation of barley and wheat. So here's the scenario. A landowner had been planting grapes, had been planting wheat or barley for a number of years. And because he read that book by George Washington Carver, or about George Washington Carver, which I happen to have seen this morning in a bookshop, and I didn't buy it, even though I admired George Washington Carver as the inventor of peanut butter. So he deserves a lot of credit for that. But he's the one who came up with this crop rotation business. So the farmer knows that the soil is kind of getting depleted from what usually feeds the wheat or the barley. And this year, because of the market, he decides he's going to plant grapes. So he plows the field over, under, however you call it, and he plants his grapevines. He is warned by these announcements on Rosh Chodesh Adar to go out and check his vineyard. He has to inspect under the vines that are, whatever, on those trellises above the ground. He has to check the ground where he did not necessarily plant wheat or barley, but maybe some leftover seeds took root and they're growing now in the field. And he is required to uproot them in order to save his crop of grapes in a halachic sense. I don't want to get too much in that, but as long as I'm mentioning it, I've mentioned it every time I bring up this Mishnah, even though it doesn't have to do with Shkalim, it does have to do with Rosh Chodesh Adar. This is the season where plants start to grow. The Mishnah says as follows. Originally, the Sanhedrin sufficed with an announcement of check your fields, and then they would send inspectors later in the month to see if farmers complied with the requirement of uprooting any stray barley or wheat that's growing there. So the Mishnah says what they originally would do was, I guess, the equivalent of wagging their finger, and they would pluck out the shoots that were growing and throw it in front of the landowner to say, you should have been doing this, not wait for the inspection to do it. Then, it says, people disregarded this warning to do that, and they waited instead for the inspectors to come and do the work. So the inspectors would take that which they pluck out, and they wouldn't throw it in front of the landowner. They would throw it into a public area where it would be a little bit more embarrassing for people to see that this person is being reprimanded for not taking out his stray wheat and barley. The Mishnah continues and says, things got so bad that people disregarded this rule. And I imagine, my own words, that they would make fun of the inspectors when they came, and they said, who cares if you make a public announcement about it? Doesn't bother me none. And the Mishnah concludes by saying, so the Sanhedrin empowered the investigators with the authority to remove ownership from all fields. That is something that a landowner is not going to laugh at. Inspector comes towards the end of Adar and finds wheat or barley growing in somebody's vineyard. He declares the land ownerless, posts a notice of that on the outside of the field or in the public record, and anyone can come and claim it. So that they're going to take seriously and pull out. Unless you think this is meddling, it's not, because we really are not concerned. That's not a good word. We really don't care. That's not a good word either. We don't even know how to put it in a nice way. We don't make a fuss about what each person is doing as far as does he keep mitzvot or not. But here we're talking about a grape grower who's going to want to market these grapes. He's got a contract with a local winery for his whole crop. That winery is going to produce kosher wine. And this guy is going to needs an inspection. He personally might not be religious and might not care about mitzvot, but if he doesn't follow the rules of Kolai Kerem, it renders his grapes not kosher. It's the equivalent, agriculturally, of an inspector for ritual slaughter. Just like Shechita does not go without checking, neither does the growing of grapes, because of the prohibition of Kolai Kerem. Now this is not like other forbidden mixtures, like grafting of one species to another, which, if someone violates that, the produce is still edible, is still kosher. If somebody, in violation of the halacha, grafts a branch with a certain fruit to the stock of a different species of fruit, and that's forbidden by the Torah also, the resulting fruit is not forbidden, which means I still could be concerned why he's not keeping the halacha, but I'm not going to get into a snit, as they say, if that's what they say, about it, because he could still bring it to the market, and I don't have the fear that I'm eating something that's not permitted. But with grapes and grain, that's an isur hana'a, which renders the crop, whether it was on purpose or not, mixed. It renders it treif, not kosher. And therefore, it was the concern of the public. I imagine they have to. Now, what else they do in our time, the equivalent of this is rabbinic certification on the kashrut of the fruits and vegetables growing in a field. You know, we think it's weird because of the countries that we came from where there were no agricultural halachot to deal with. But when you, or not many of them anyway, but when you have a situation here where if a field does not have trumot and masrot taken, at least in token fashion, as is the requirement of our time, a kosher outlet is not going to buy this produce. So non-kosher kibbutzim, non-religious kibbutzim, even anti-religious kibbutzim, if they want the kosher market, which in this country is significant, then they will have an inspector, and he will be able to attest to the fact that trumot and masrot were taken, and that there is no chashash of orla, etc., etc. But we digress. Again, one view is the mitzvah to read Parshat Shkalim is a commemoration based on the Mishnah that says it was on the first of Adar that the announcement was made for the collection of Shkalim. That's why they said the Shabbat Av, or right before Rosh Chodesh Adar, that's when we will read Parshat Shkalim. Now, the other reason that's given for it will sound very similar to the above, but it's one notch more. It's called V'nishalma Parim Sfateinu. The Navi says, and the concept that comes from it is that after the ceasing of animal sacrifices, our lips replaced the animals of the altar. Meaning prayer is now the way we serve God, and temporarily we don't have korbanot. This concept of unishalma parim svatenu, that our lips replace the oxen, is expanded and applied, for example, to a mitzvah like machatzit ha-shekel. You're supposed to give a silver half shekel to the Beit HaMikdash. What? No Beit HaMikdash? No Sanhedrin? Well, we can't do that mitzvah now, so we will more than commemorate it, we will do it in the replacement way of doing it, which is reading the portion and get credit as if we did the mitzvah. That's called Unashama Parim Svatena. According to the Talmud Yerushalmi, there's an extra dimension to Shkalim, and I think it's a very significant one, and that is not just its being associated with the first of Adar that the Mishnah mentions, but Dafka being before Purim, because in the story of Purim, in the Megillah, we read that Haman, who desired to destroy every man, woman, and child, the nation of Mordechai, goes to Ahasuerus, and he gives him a sales pitch. He says, you've got these people scattered among your provinces, and they don't listen to you, and it's really not kedai to keep them around. But in addition to giving him a pitch for permission to destroy the Jewish people, he says, I will enrich your treasury. And I can imagine Ahasuerus sort of perking up when he heard the fact that there's financial gain here. And he offered him the sum of 10,000 kikar kesef, talents of silver, for the job. The commentaries tell us that one talent equals 300, or is it 3,000? I don't remember. 300 or 30. Forget that. I don't remember the exact number. But it's a number of shekels that if you multiply 10,000 by that number, you get the equivalent of 600,000 half shekels. In other words, 300,000 shekels. Well, let's do the math. 600,000 people is the figurative number, the approximate number that's given for all the Jewish people. And if they each give a half shekel, that's 300,000 shekels. Divide that by 10,000 is 300 divided by 10 is 30. So it was a kikar kesef, a talent of silver equals 30 silver shekels, and therefore the command to bring the half shekel from all of the Jewish people as required would total an amount equal to that amount that Haman offered for our demise. So the expression is, our shkalim came before Haman's shkalim. It's like taking a vaccination. You don't wait until you get sick with the disease, but you vaccinate yourself in order not to fall prey to the disease. Similarly, the Yerushalmi looks at our shkalim, our machatzit shekel, as a vaccination against Haman's shkalim, dooming Haman's plot to failure before it got off the ground. So that's the other explanation to the shkalim. I mentioned earlier that there might be a practical difference between the two opinions, whether this is commemorative shkalim or it's a substitute fulfillment. A footnote in this book, the book is Adar Upurim, Adar Ufurim really, Adar and Purim by Rav Yoel Schwartz. He brings in a footnote that there might be a difference as to whether a katan, a boy under the age of mitzvot, is allowed to read Parshat Shkalim. If it is, today we're noheg, our practice is that only above bar mitzvah read the Arba Parshiot, but technically a katan is allowed to read Maftir. Not Zohar, because it's a Torah fulfillment, but Shkalim, maybe. If Shkalim is only commemorative, then perhaps a katan is allowed to read it. If it is fulfillment in a substitute way, then a katan would not be eligible to take care of the obligation of the community based on his reading, and it would have to be only a gadol. And some actually say it has to be from the age of 20 and up, since they were the ones who were obligated on the machatzit shekel. Just as a side piece, a little trivia, this Shabbat, three Torahs. First Torah is Parshat HaShavua. Second Torah is Rosh Chodesh. Third Torah is Shkalim. Let's say a shul makes a mistake. They read the number of people for the Parshat HaShavua, and then they read Shkalim by mistake. And then they read Rosh Chodesh. If that happens, the Haftorah switches. The Haftorah, which is a special Haftorah for Parshat Shkalim, is preempted in that case by the Haftorah for Rosh Chodesh. Because there's a general rule of thumb that a Haftorah always follows the last thing you read in the Torah. Now, it doesn't have to be like I described. It could happen like this. They took out two Torahs. They forgot it was Rosh Chodesh. They remembered that it was Shkalim. And after they read the Parshat HaShavua and Shkalim, somebody said, hey, what about Rosh Chodesh? So they take out another Torah and they read Rosh Chodesh, but since they don't reread Shkalim, because that was fine, then the Haftorah becomes the Rosh Chodesh Haftorah. As usual, there's a lot more that I would love to share with you, and hopefully we'll have. One of the messages of Shkalim, though, that I would like to leave you with is the fact that the particular denomination, if you call it that, of half a shekel, if there is a coin in Israel, past, future, that is called a shmergel, and a shmergel is equal to a half shekel, you don't give a silver shmergel for this mitzvah. You have to go to a money changer and change your shmergel into a half shekel, because the fraction half means not whole. I am a Jew, part of Klal Yisrael. That membership is a very, very precious thing, and it conveys the feeling of sharing with my fellow Jews, so that in the time of the Beit HaMikdash, past and future, all the communal offerings, all of the community-related issues that are for all people are shared by all people equally, who contribute half silver shekel to the Machatzit HaShekel collection. And what I always like to point out, the salt for every single korban, for every sacrifice, communal as well as personal. The salt, which has to be on every single one, comes from the communal fund. That means there is no such thing as I, me, myself, alone, am doing this. My endeavor, in a spiritual sense, is because of my membership and partnership with Bnei Israel, with my fellow Jews, and that is a very important message to carry through. I wish you all a Shabbat Shalom, a Chodesh Tov, Shkalim Tovim, and enjoy your three kugels. L'hishtameah.